if you tell somebody, I want you to love your neighbor. They know what to do? Suppose they say, okay, I saw my neighbor, and I tell you what, they're good looking. I love them. You said love your neighbor.
Well, I would stop there. I'd tell them more about it.
What would you tell them?
Say, love thy neighbor. Some people have different...
No, you can't do all of that. You got to do it in two words.
Love them as you love yourself.
As yourself. You were going to say some good thing, but what I was looking for is this. As yourself. Now, does that mean fall in love with your neighbor?
No.
No. And so, as yourself qualifies, doesn't it? And gives us some information about this commandment, which Jesus said is the second greatest commandment, and that all the commandments hang or depend upon these two commandments, love God with all your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself. So, our focus has been on that second part of that, the as yourself. And so today, last couple lessons, we looked at the concept of being a woman and what God expects out of women and why women should have self-esteem and be esteemed by others as made in the image of God. We looked at her roles as a wife and a mother and why she should not be ashamed to fulfill the role that God equipped her for. And then we looked at the fact that women were commended by God for other roles, even outside the family role. So women have a variety of potential. We're turning our attention now to the concept of a man. And so if you'll look at your lesson here, we have this beginning paragraph. When people may look at the television and here's this guy that's on the TV and he weighs about 285 pounds. His muscles are bulging. He's 6'6". And they say, boy, that's a man. What do they mean?
Big, strong.
Big, strong. That's what they're esteeming on the basis of. So now you go look in the mirror, and you're 4'9" and weigh 90 pounds. Uh-oh, are you a man? And so men are sometimes esteemed on the basis of their strength, their size. It may be their athleticism. It may be their wealth. It may be their education. You say, boy, he's a PhD. It may be their accomplishments, their status in life. Man, he's a CEO of a big company. And while these are certainly considerations, as I put in the paragraph, that one would have to consider. For example, if you were choosing someone for your track team, you would want to know about his size, about his athleticism. If you were choosing somebody to run a company, you would want to know something about his financial capabilities, his business acumen. And so in certain areas, those things are considerations. But loving your neighbor is not dependent on any of that. You love your neighbor, whether he's strong or whether he's weak, whether he's tall or whether he's short, whether he's wealthy or whether he's poor. And none of that should affect our esteem of our fellow man. But where does it begin to be able to treat my fellow man that way?
Yourself.
Yourself. As yourself. And so if men have a low self-esteem because I've never accomplished anything, I've not made a lot of money, then how will that affect loving or esteeming or honoring their neighbor? And thus the importance of our study. And so our last sentence in that paragraph, we must beware lest we let the standard rob us of the potential and love due every man made in the image of God. How important is that concept for a wife? That she esteem her husband not on the basis of whether he's a trash collector or a CEO, not on the basis of whether he can run or not, or hit a baseball, but rather he's made in the image of God. And so it's across the board value to understand why we ought to esteem ourselves, and that certainly applies to the male. Now in the second paragraph, we turn a little bit our attention from the standpoint that God has chosen men, and when I say men here, I'm talking about males. God has chosen males to function in certain roles. Turn to Genesis chapter 18, verse 19. Genesis 18:19. One of the great men of the Old Testament is Abraham, and usually we think of Abraham and we remember his what? His faith. But look what's spoken of here, and it's in connection with his faith, no doubt. But look here how he's spoken of in verse 19. God said, I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. And so, certainly Abraham being a man of obedient faith, God knew he could select him to fulfill this responsibility of instilling in his posterity the knowledge and faith in Almighty God so that God would bring about the promise that he had made relative to the nation that would issue forth from Abraham. But Abraham here, Sarah is not mentioned. Not that she didn't have a responsibility, but what's mentioned here is Abraham and his role as the one to instill the knowledge and faith of God in those that would proceed from him. And oftentimes when we think about children learning about God and fearing God and knowing his will, where does that often fall? Who's on the mother? And mothers have a very important role. We saw that in our last two classes where we saw women like Eunice and Lois, the grandmother and mother of Timothy, and of course the mother of Moses and others. Mothers have a tremendous role. But you can see here that God said, I've chosen Abraham to command his children and his household after him. And so in the family, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, we see it's the male that has been given a leadership role in the family. Now, with leadership comes what?
Responsibility.
And with responsibility sometimes comes heartache. With responsibility sometimes comes disappointment. With responsibility you've got to make decisions. But that's part of it. Man has been put in the leadership role in the family. 1 Peter 3 Verse 4, the way he approaches it, you know, never unless I've missed it in the Bible, is the man commanded to rule his wife. What God does is tell the woman to respect the role that God gave the man, and that is to be the leader in the family. So that's what we have here about a godly woman. In verse 5, in this way, that is, in a gentle and quiet spirit, not a combative spirit, this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husband. Now, did the world do that? Not necessarily, but holy women, women set apart for God, did. And he uses Sarah, and says Sarah called him Lord, and Lord was simply a term of respect, a recognition of authority. And so he says, you've become her children, if you do what is right. It's the right thing to do, to recognize that God, not the man, God put the man in that position. Now, verse 7, I think on your lesson, I just have verses 5 and 6, but look at verse 7. You husbands in the same way. So here's the, wife told to respect her husband's rule, then he turns his attention to the man. He says, you are to live with your wife in an understanding way. So it's not simply as, well, I know how my daddy treated my mama. That's not it. It's not how the guys at work talk about treating their wives. It's not just, I'm going to get out here in the midst of the ocean and hope I can find my way. I need to understand some things in my role of leadership in an understanding way. And here he says, as with a weaker vessel. Not that a woman is weaker, but you recognize the fact that you can crush her, you can ruin her, you can hurt her, and you use your leadership role in view of that. As with a weaker vessel. And then he says, since she's a woman, and it says, show her honor. The word love, love your neighbor. Early in our studies, we ask you for some synonyms of love your neighbor. Do you remember some of those we talked about? What?
Respect.
Respect. Is that the same thing as honor? It is, isn't it? Esteem. That's the kind of love we're talking about. Look what he say. He says, show her honor. Would that not be the same thing as love her as you love yourself? No, as a fellow heir of the grace of life. That is, you're made in the image of God, so is she. And so show her honor, respect her. She's on the same level you are. Authority, yes, God's given you the leadership role. And so be a man, accept that responsibility. There are men who will not accept that responsibility. Unfortunately, it forces the woman to have to take a role that she may not want because the man simply will not accept his responsibility. That's why we have on this lesson, accept yourself being a man. And God put the male in the family in that role. And so, like it or not, that's what we as men need to prepare ourselves to do and be leaders in the family. As you continue here on the lesson, I said in the Old Testament, men were also soldiers and leaders in the military. That was by God's plan. It's interesting that although Deborah was a judge, did she lead the army?
No,
she didn't. She encouraged Barak to lead the army. That's interesting, isn't it? And so, even in that particular case, and then I have examples, Joshua, Saul, David. Could a woman lead an army? I suppose. In history, there's been notable women in history that led powerful armies. But God's plan, as far as we know in the Old Testament, was men be the leaders in the military. And then we have civil leaders. They were to appoint judges. Over the tribes, heads of tribes. Weren't these all males? So people had to come to the judge for a decision. They selected men from among that were supposed to be wise men that they could trust. And then religious leaders. How many women priests? None that I know of. And so you have the tribe of the Levites, but it's the males there who serve in the helping the priest in the work. And you go through the Old Testament and you see a number of different preachers or prophets, and you've got all these books. How many books in the Old Testament?
22?
39. Oh, 39. Okay. 39. How many of them are written by women? What?
None.
Zero. That's right, none. Does that God mean God doesn't honor women? No. What it does say that God used men in a leadership role in religion. And so oftentimes it's the women behind the men that made them what they are, like Deborah behind Barak, for example. But nevertheless, that was God's plan. Now in the New Testament, Jesus chose 12 men to be his special representative, Matthew 10. Were there any women? Maybe there was no women around that he could have chose from. We studied in our previous lesson about that. Is that correct?
No.
No, there were some women that accompanied him in his ministry and even contributed to his support. But he chose 12 males to be his apostles in that leadership role, sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And then when it came to selecting bishops, overseers, again, it was the male that God selected to be in that leadership role. Now, you notice I've got a sentence here. I've got it underlined on my lesson because this is important. Qualified men must be men enough to accept this responsibility with courage and humility. And one of the reasons oftentimes we do not have men who will accept those responsibilities, either as the leader of the family or a leader in the church, is because they're not quote unquote man enough to accept that responsibility. We sometimes use the term, man up. Be a man. Is that a biblical idea, to be a man, act like a man? Yes, it is. And so, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Verse 13. The Corinthian church was a church full of turmoil. You try to think about yourself living there. According to the first four chapters, what was one of the problems inside the congregation that caused turmoil?
Division
over leaders that were trying to assume the leadership and undermine Paul's ministry. First four chapters devoted to it. So you think, well, it wasn't always peaceful. There were people vying for position and vying for followers. What problem did they face in chapter 5 and 6?
Morality.
Fornication. You're among God's people. What kind of issues arose that they dealt with? He dealt with in a letter in chapter 7.
About marriage.
Here's a church that has questions about marriage. Can I get rid of my husband who's not a believer, for example? Those kind of things. And then you had turmoil in chapter 8 about what? No, chapter 8. You're in 6. 8.
Food to idols.
What?
Food to idols.
Food. Eating food that had been offered to idols. Can you eat that meat? And some of the brethren had trouble with it. Some didn't. And so there was the problem of another's conscience and my liberties. And so you had that. He dealt with that in chapter 8, 9, and 10. And then when you get to chapter 11, somebody says something about the Lord's Supper. Imagine a church where you come together and people are bringing their food and you got the haves and the have-nots and they won't share with one another and they get through and say, okay, now let's observe the Lord's Supper together. You be looking for another congregation? Nothing about that. Nothing about that. But he addresses that issue. And then in chapter 12, 13, and 14, what was the problem?
Spiritual gifts.
And people had the gift of tongues. They thought they ought to be able to use them, whether anybody knew what they was talking about or not. You had to address that. Do you get discouraged? Do you say, I'm just tired of fighting? The battle, I started off pretty good, but I'm getting battle weary and I'm ready to give up. And it looks like we've got some strong opposition. Now we're chapter 16 here. And look at verse 13. This is the imagery of battle, if I understand it. So remember, they did battle on foot. No airplanes and that kind of thing. So here you're in the army and the enemy's out there. So first thing, you better be on the alert. You don't know when they're going to come over the hill. They're going to be right in front of you. Be on the alert. When you see them, what do? You don't run. You stand firm in the faith. Look at this next phrase. Now they've got their weapons out. They're marching to you. You pull out your weapon. What do now? You act like men. We'll see in just a moment what that means. you act like men. You're not a little, bunch of little boys run and hide. You fight this battle. You act like men. And as the battle wages on and you get weary, what do? You be strong. You don't give in and give up. And so, you know, a child, when it sees danger, it may run. It may run to mama, go hide behind her skirts, you know, that kind of thing. You can't do that. And when a child gets tired of something, they're ready to move on to something else. No. Act like men. Now, the reason I'm convinced that this phrase, act like men, has to do with courage and perseverance in the face of difficulty and trials, not only the phrase itself in the context in which it is, but the word that he uses is one word that this phrase translates, one word, actually. And if you'll go back in your Bible, I have here on your lesson, Joshua chapter 1. Now, obviously, the Old Testament was not written in Greek. It was written in Hebrew. But a Greek translation was made of the Old Testament about 150, 250 years before Christ, called the Septuagint version. And so the translators had to translate the Hebrew and select Greek words to represent what the Hebrew was saying. So here in Joshua chapter 1, in these verses that I have on your lesson, verse 6, 7, 9, and 18, four times in this chapter, they use the same word that you find in 1 Corinthians 16. Same word. And in fact, in some versions, in these verses, you will have the phrase, quit like yourselves like men. But this is the New American Standard, so look at verse 6. Be strong and courageous. The word translated courageous, same word as 1 Corinthians 16, 13. In the original language, in the Greek language. That's the word they chose to represent whatever Hebrew word that was. Be strong and courageous, for you will give this people possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. What's standing before Joshua that would make the need for him, for God to admonish him to courage?
Pharisees.
What?
Pharisees,
did you say?
They're fixing to take.
You're way down the line, I think. You're in the New Testament, okay?
Take the land.
What do they got to do before they take the land?
Fight the battle on the shoulders. People that live there.
What do they got to do before they fight the people that live there?
Trust God.
What do they got to do to get over there? I got a bridge they're going over? What?
Cross the river.
They got to go through a river. But wait, they got kids. They got animals. It's going to be a sloshy mess, ain't it? Whoa. Well, I hope the kids don't drown. Be strong and courageous. I'm going to give you the land. How are you going to do it? I'm going to give you the land. You just trust me. You be strong and courageous. And so, there's a need indeed. I promised it. I'm going to keep my promise.
He said so, in verse 5, as I was with Moses, I will also be with you.
Very good. As I was with Moses, I'll be with you and I'll not forsake you. So there's the assurance. There's a reason he could have courage. God said, I'll be with you. You just do what I tell you. I'll be with you. And so look at verse 7. Be strong and very courageous. Now here you have it again. It's interesting that not once, not twice, not three times, but four times he tells him this. You think of Joshua, strong leader, and yet God's encouraging him. Be courageous. Act like a man, Joshua. And so he said, be careful. Now, in this verse 7, very interesting. Courageous. Demands what? Look, be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left. To be strong is to be courageous to follow the law. Now, is he going to face opposition about following what Moses said? Drop down to verse 18. Anyone who rebels against your command and does not obey your words and all that you command him shall be put to death. You mean there's going to be opposition from the ranks? Yes. There can be people saying, Joshua, you're crazy. We can't do this. Yes. You do what God told you to do, just like Moses. You don't turn to the right or to the left. You have the courage to follow the will of God. That's the kind of man God wanted Joshua to be. Act like a man. Use that word. When you get to verse 9, have I not commanded you? You have two motivations for acting like a man in this verse. Look what they are. One, I commanded you. That's number one. He said, be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed. And here's the second motivation. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Sally already made reference to that earlier, back up in verse 5. So here's the motivation. I'm commanding you, and look, I'm going to be with you. You be strong and courageous. That's the kind of men we ought to aspire to be. And that's what was needed in the church at Corinth. Act like men. And so, even the women would have to have that kind of courage in the face of these trials. But certainly the males would. And unfortunately, sometimes women have more courage to stand up and withstand than sometimes men do. That's sad, men. That's a shame on us. Now, when we talk about men having this kind of courage, you'll note I have here on this paragraph, this does not imply that men are to be bullies and tyrants and dictators. Look at 3 John verse 9. Men sometimes confuse this. Well, to be a man, boy, I got to push people around and insist on my way and not pay attention to counsel, not examine what I'm doing. If I ever question myself, then I'm not a man. Let me ask you a question before I read 3 John about that very thing. In a previous lesson, we talked about a man, and he was indeed a man. He was a courageous man. He was a leader of God's people. He led armies in battle. But he was willing to consider advice, even from a woman. Who was he?
David.
That's right. But here's Diotrephes. I wrote somewhat to the church first now, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, hey, I'm the man, I run things here, does not accept what we say. John says, I'll deal with him. He accuses us falsely. I guess he thought he was a big boss. He could do what he wanted to. That's not what's involved in being a man. Being pig-headed, bull-headed, selfish. That's not what God's talking about. And Diotrephes is a warning about that. Look at 1 Samuel 25. 1 Samuel 25. So what the Holy Spirit has done is provide us a balance. While He tells men to be men, He also provides us some information to keep our sense of balance on this concept. Here you have a guy called Nabal. In 1 Samuel 25, verse 10, you know, David's servants went to him and said, look, we've protected your herds and flocks and we need some food for our army. Nabal, a rich man. Here's Nabal's response. He's tough, boy. He says, who is David? Who's the son of Jesse? There are many servants today who he's breaking away from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have slaughtered for my shears and give it to the men whose origin I do not know? In other words, get out of here. Boy, isn't that tough? Isn't he a man? Look down at verse 17. End of the verse. He's a worthless man that no one can speak to him. You see, men who think that's what being a man is. I'm not listening to anybody. Don't talk to me. That would be a threat to my manhood. No, it isn't. And so while we read this statement over here in 1 Corinthians 16, act like a man. Quit yourselves like men. That it's not encouraging these aberrations that we're talking about here. Now, when we talk about acting like a man, 1 Corinthians 16, we showed the setting. But there are certainly some areas in which God has put men in positions of leadership where we need that kind of man particularly. Turn to Acts chapter 20. Acts chapter 20. Paul is talking about that he's with the elders. He's got a class with the elders, the church at Ephesus, and he's talking to them about their role. And he said, verse 18, middle of the verse, "You yourselves know from the first day I set foot in Asia how I was with you the whole time, serving the Lord with all humility and with tears and with trials which came on me through the plots of the Jews. And how I did not shrink from declaring to you anything that was profitable and teaching you publicly and from house to house, solemnly testifying to both Jews and Greeks of repentance toward God and faith in our Lord Jesus Christ." So there I was, being threatened, all kind of dangers, but he said, I didn't hold back. I preached whatever was necessary. And you get down a little bit further, down to verse 26. "I testify to you this day, I'm innocent of the blood of all men, for I did not shrink from declaring to you the whole purpose of God." So, that's the kind of elders we need. We have in churches across this land men who are called elders. They can meet in the back room, make a decision, fire the preacher, hire a preacher, decide who's coming in a meeting, who's going to do the yard. But when it comes to having the courage to go sit down across the table from somebody and talk to them about their soul, when it comes to the need to stand up to a doctor fees, they don't have the guts. And you know what? They're not men enough to be elders. Elders need to be men that act like men and have the courage to stand. Same with preachers. Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 4. Timothy evidently was going through a phase of maybe holding back. And you'll see in chapter 1, 6, he says, "Kindle afresh the gift of God which is in you. Don't be ashamed." Verse 8, "Go ahead and suffer for the gospel." Then at the end of the letter, chapter 4, verse 2, he said, "Preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season." What does that mean? You know what it means. Whether people like it or don't like it. In season, out of season. "Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. The time will come they'll not endure sound doctrine, wanting to have their ears tickled. They'll accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance with their own desires." Well, if they're going to accumulate for themselves teachers according to their own desires, what's going to happen to Timothy? You're out of here, bud.
He shouldn't worry about that.
That's right. Should never worry about that. Any preacher that's preaching for a job, for a paycheck, ought to go do something else. Because that's going to influence him. Well, I may lose my job. I may lose my pay. I may get kicked out. Forget it. When they threaten you with your check, you just tell them to keep the money. He says, "Timothy, you preach, whether people like it or don't like it." He said, verse 5, "Be sober in all things, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist." So there are males that are evangelists that are not men. Act like a man. Be a man. And so, here we have these admonitions that should help us who are males in this audience to fill the roles that God has equipped us for. Any comments before I move to this last paragraph? "All men are made in the image of God. But are all men qualified to be apostles?" No. No. "All men qualified to be elders?" No. "Does this change the fact they're made in the image of God?"
No.
No. So it doesn't change their inherent worth, does it? Just because they're not qualified, there's only 12 men Jesus chose out of all the people of his day to be apostles. And although in a congregation, like the churches that you read about in the first preaching journey, or the church at Philippi. I don't know how large it was. There might just be a select group of men that were qualified to serve in the capacity of elders. It doesn't mean that the other men in the congregation were of any less importance or should be less esteemed for their human worth. And if those who are serving in those capacities get that idea, they've got a wrong impression. Remember, the apostles had a problem with that, didn't they? They had a problem with pride instead of looking at themselves as servants. So that can go to a fellow's head, and that's a wrong concept. And so I have here Lazarus, Luke 16. And so here you have Lazarus and a rich man. So you see a guy like Lazarus. No job. He can't. Remember, this society is not like our society. You can't go down and apply for welfare. You can't go get Medicaid. The government's not going to take care of you because you don't have any money. He's a beggar, full of sores. You see him there on the street. How do you think of Lazarus? How do we today esteem a Lazarus? I'm not talking about a bum who won't work. I'm talking about that. Every man is made in the image of God, whether he's a Lazarus or whether he is a Zacchaeus. So look over at Luke 19. Here's the opposite side of the coin. Sometimes it works in reverse. Because a man is wealthy, people have a bias against him, as if he can't be a godly man, a man of faith. In Luke 19, 1 through 10, you have the story about Zacchaeus, a wealthy man. Verse 2, he was rich. He did have employment. He was a tax collector, a job that many people didn't have a whole lot of regard for. But note verse 5, Jesus said, told him when he saw him up in the tree, "Today I must stay at your house." And of course the people said, "Oh, he's a sinner, blah, blah." And verse 9, Jesus said, "Today salvation has come to this house, because he too is a son of Abraham. The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." And you know what? That includes the rich tax collector and the poor beggar, because they're made in the image of God. And that should tell us something about loving our neighbor. And so I have here on the lesson, all men are made in the image of God, including the lame, John 5, the lame man Jesus healed, the blind man, John 9, who restored his sight, blind from birth. What could he do? Especially in their society, what could he do? But Jesus had regard for that man and his soul. And then, of course, we mentioned Lazarus and Zacchaeus. So men and women need to understand the fact and accept the implications of all men being made in the image of God. Look at Titus chapter 2. We've only got just a few minutes left. Titus chapter 2. Titus is a young preacher on the island of Crete. And he's told the things he needs to preach, chapter 2:1. Speak the things that are fitting for sound doctrine. Some of the things he might preach, people may not like, but note verse 15. These things speak and exhort and reprove with all authority. Let no one disregard you. He said some things in chapter 1, for example, that were pretty hard. He said verse 12, Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. That's not every Cretan person on the island of Crete. That was just true of their society in general. And he talked about people there who were teaching things, verse 11, for the sake of sordid gain. They need to be stopped. And who should stop them? Those elders who had courage. That's what he talks about. And so now you come to chapter 2. And in verse 2, he talks about older men. And down in verse 6, he talks about young men. But what kind of older men and young men does he have in view? Okay, verse 11 and 12 tells us, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to deny ungodliness and worldly desires, and to live sensibly, righteously, and godly in this present age. He's talking about older men who live sensibly, righteously, and godly, and young men who are godly as well. And he talks about what kind of men these older men and younger men, godly older men and godly young women, are to be. So older men who are godly, to be temperate. They still retain self-control. Just because you're old and sometimes crabby, I've heard of old men who get a little crabby, but be temperate and dignified and sensible and sound in faith and love and perseverance. Sometimes old men think because they're old, they don't have to exercise that kind of self-discipline. Age doesn't excuse that. In fact, if anything, there ought to be an example as they get older. And then you got the young men who sometimes may use their youth as an excuse not to accept their responsibility. But look, he says in verse 6, urge the young men to be sensible in all things, showing yourself to be an example of good deeds, with purity and doctrine, dignified, sound in speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Wouldn't it be great? We have so many young men right here in this congregation. And of course, young man here doesn't mean teenager. May include them, but young married men. And I'm so thankful to God, and I do thank Him in my prayers, that we have young men in this congregation. We're trying to live that way. And they're examples. They're encouraging, and they're trying to be men of character and holiness. And that's what God wants you to be. And God equipped us to be that kind of being. And so here's God's plan for the man in His image. Any other comments about this lesson?
Steve.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned earlier a word there that's, I think, kind of important. It helps us understand about this image of God. You said it was inherent. I think that's a good way to look at it.
That I said what?
It was inherent. So every person has it, not based on what they do or who they are.
Good. Well, I'm glad I got something right. That's good. All right. Thank you, Rocky. That's a good point, though. It's inherent. It's not something you've done or that kind of, it's that part of it. It's, you're just made in the image of God. I'm glad Rocky pointed that out. It's good. Now, on your next lesson, by the way, the first paragraph has a typo. You may have already found it. In that first paragraph, I said the scriptures in the following lesson will show that women can have tremendous value. Obviously, that's supposed to be men. But, so, just a mistake there you might want to correct. Lord willing, our next class, Sunday morning, we'll talk about accept men, accepting themselves. And we're going to talk about men who obtained a testimony, just like we looked at women who obtained a testimony from God. We're going to look at why some men were commended by God. That should be an encouragement to each one of us who are men, and to our wives as they encourage us to be that kind of man. Okay, thank you for your attention this evening.